You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. The dangers of doing events after lunch. I'm Aaron Klein. I'm a fellow in economic studies and the policy director of the Center on Regulation of Markets, and it's my distinct honor and privilege to welcome all of you here. There's some seats up front, so everybody standing in the back, come on, join. It's more fun up front, I promise. Maybe I'll tell you the slides are really small font, so it's hard to see in the back. I don't know, but everybody Everybody ought to come up and start. And I thought I'd start today by starting on how this project came to be. I was in Shanghai about 3 years ago on a totally different issue, having a set of meetings to try and understand more about the financial stability of the Chinese banking system. And I had a friend from Shanghai, and I was really excited to use this opportunity to buy some clothes. The suit you see and the shirt I'm wearing off my back were purchased in a souk in Shanghai by my friend's custom tailor. And I go into this kind of like old shopping mall with these rows and rows and rows of tailors, all competing, yelling, come on, you know, check, I have the best, I have the best. And I go to this guy, we make the deal, you know, take my measurements, a couple suits. And before going, having been an international traveler and having gone to many of these kinds of places, I made sure to go to the ATM to have cash. And when we finally haggled and negotiated the price, I pulled out my money. And she said, no. And she said, Alipay. And I said, what? She said, WeChat. I said, huh? I said, I have cash. No, I don't want that. I said, you don't want cash. I said, here's a card. She goes, no, I don't take American credit cards. And that I kind of had expected. But what do you mean you don't take cash? She said, no. And my friend who said to me said, oh, no, they all use these phone barcode things. You know, obviously my friend's American. He doesn't have it. After a lot of lengthy negotiations, she reluctantly agreed to take my cash. And I said to myself, what the heck is going on here when these types of stores don't want your cash? And I came back and I started doing some research. And it started to jibe with what I'd seen, which was China was experiencing a revolution in their payment system. And it's one that hasn't been fully understood or appreciated. And I applied for a grant, and thank you to the Rubenstein Chinese grant program at Brookings, which funded this research. And here are the results that I'm excited to share with you. So I want to start by talking about a payment system. Because people don't appreciate, we take this for granted, but our entire economy works on creating efficient payment mechanisms. You can't buy or sell or transact in a modern capitalist society without an incredibly efficient, effective, and secure payment system, as Chairman Powell recently stated. In China, their payment system is totally different from what we're used to in the U.S. And the way I'm going to try and structure this talk is explain and bring you from like a 101 understanding of Chinese payments to a 2 or 301, then describe what it means and describe what it means for the how it relates to the U.S. context and why what I think is a fantastic new payment system in China isn't going to come to the U.S. in a broad way. And I'll tell you why I don't think we're all going to be using these systems. And then explain a little bit about the differences and yet what it means globally. So how the system works is very simple. Everything has a QR code. The photo on the left is a parking garage at a hotel at the conference I was in Shenzhen. And the way it works is you go in the parking and you scan your code. And then when you scan your code to go out, that your phone triggers that you've paid parking and you go in and out. No little tickets, right? Who doesn't love to search for their parking card ticket, right? The timestamp is there. It's efficient. It's effective. On the right is just a typical merchant, Alipay. You can see here, and this is WeChat in green. These are the two dominant forms. You have a QR code on your phone, and the merchant can scan it. Or you pull up your camera app within the app, and you scan the merchant's code. And anybody can have a code anywhere. Any sheet of paper can be printed out and turned into a QR code. This is not hyperbole, but this has replaced tin cups for beggars on the street. You walk down in China and there's a beggar holding a piece of paper and you just scan that and then you've made payment to them. And then when they go to a store to get something to eat, they put their piece of paper up and it gets scanned. That's how you can make charity. So here's how the system went, what I would call mega viral. These are number of active users, and it ends in 2018. Alipay has reported passing a billion users. These are thousands of millions, hundreds and thousands of millions. But you go back a few years, you've gone from 100 million to a billion users, 355 in WeChat. And the origin stories of the two are a little different. So let me start with WeChat. WeChat was started by something called red packets. So in China, what they tend to give is cash around New Year's. In the U.S., for whatever reason, we don't give cash, if you guys recall that famous Seinfeld episode where they tried to give cash as a gift. Economists are perplexed by this because actually you should know what you should want with your money rather than me. So an economic rational person should only give cash to other economic rational people. If you want to know the limits of economics, look under a Christmas tree. But in China, this is what they do. And they created this experience in WeChat that just took off, right? 2015 it starts, 2016. By 2017, you're getting almost 50 million people getting a person-to-person. This seeds your digital envelope, your digital wallet. So instead of getting, you know, in the U.S., maybe you get a, you know, one of the last few checks you get is in a birthday or Christmas card from your aunt, right? This is all an electronic experience networked through WeChat, which is kind of Chinese Facebook. It's important to understand at the beginning, for those of you who don't know, Alipay is kind of like Amazon digital commerce platform. WeChat's kind of like Facebook, giant social media. And this seeds that wallet there. Alipay is a little bit different. It's seeded more the same way that we enter into all of our credit cards when you enter into Amazon or Amazon Prime. That's the origin story for Alipay. This is how much money is moving. This is hundreds of trillions of Chinese currency. So the 2018 figure is roughly $50 trillion, a little bit below that. That's capital T trillion. Think about, for those of us who've studied international digital finance, how much has been written on M-Pesa, the digital wallet situation in Kenya. We're not talking about trillions, let alone $50 trillion. These are gross flows. They're not total dollar amount, right? I can red envelope person to person or retail to retail. These are gross flows. These are huge amounts of money. So how does the system work? This is the basic, this is as simple a photo as you can get, and I apologize. You have a person, and they can transact directly with a merchant through a QR code. Either I scan the merchant's QR code or the merchant scans mine. I have a digital wallet that's linked to the QR code that's can be linked to a bank account. It actually doesn't have to be. I'm not just a researcher of this. I'm a user. I got a Chinese friend of mine to send me some money on my WeChat, and I now exist in the ecosystem. But for most people, they have money in their bank. They upstream it to their digital wallet. It goes immediately to the merchant's digital wallet. The merchant, if they want, can downstream it to the bank, or they can recycle it within that ecosystem and purchase more things in that ecosystem using their digital wallet. One thing you'll find in the report is that, and this will, we'll get back to this, downstreaming it to the bank has a fee. Existing within your ecosystem does not, which generates both savings but also some potential competitive concerns and questions. And then the merchant can access the digital wallet directly or the bank. I'm just going to compare it for a second. This is what the U.S. system looks like, right? You see that thing in the middle? That's a point-of-sale terminal. We've all seen those. You see the big difference? The point-of-sale terminal, there are only about 30 million point-of-sale terminals in China, right? For an economy of their size with that number of people, it was hard for me to find an actual U.S. number. I couldn't quite find how many U.S. point-of-sale, hundreds of millions of those little machines, right? That machine has a bank, which then has a different intermediary situation. So you see you've gone from three banks, the payment processor bank, into this, right? Now, Let's return back to the American system, which we all know. In this system, you have a card. And the card is the reader, the intermediary that goes through it. And contrary to your understanding, the card is your financial transaction account, right? You don't have a Visa or a MasterCard. They're not lending you money. There's a bank that's lending you money that's standing behind that credit or debit card, or a prepaid issuer that's holding that card. And that bank is standing between that, and that's who's providing you funds, whether it's your own bank through a debit card. Now, in America, these cards are incredibly popular. The growth of non-cash transactions, there's another slide that could be shown about the decline in check volume, where America's not becoming a cashless society, contrary to what some folks may write. But we are increasingly becoming a card-based system, which is growing, these are over 100 billion payments, not dollars, just transactions. So what's in your wallet? Here's a situation I want to pull the room. How many people in the room have a prepaid card? I got two hands. One out of every 10 swipes in America is a prepaid card. That's how different this room is demographically from America. And what you have to appreciate here is this is highly correlated with income. So you see the average cash value for a credit card just under $100, for a debit card around 40, and for a prepaid just a little bit over 20. If I know how you pay, I probably know what kind of income you have. And the forms that we have in America of payment are very highly correlated to income and have very different economics up the income ladder. And the growing size of prepaid, 131 billion transactions in the U.S. from a form of payment that only two people in the room have, right? How many of you think about on your own side, how many of you use debit cards versus credit cards, right? You'll see debit cards are the predominant form of transaction, although credit cards have much higher volume, right? Almost twice as, more than twice as much money per swipe, and, you know, about 80% as many number of transactions. These are highly correlated to income. Another big difference in the Chinese system. In the Chinese system, it's almost universal adoption, not really that differentiated among income. In part, it's because the Chinese system has very little credit card adoption, despite a world of having 7 billion bank accounts. So, let me pause for a second and talk about the one U.S. retailer that's had the most success in making people move into a digital mobile wallet, and that's Starbucks. You see 30% of Starbucks transactions are on a digital wallet. How many people here have a Starbucks digital wallet? Right? That just crunched the number of debit card users. You can see where they stack up in terms of your deposits. The economics of the Starbucks digital wallet, and Starbucks moves more money than Apple Pay, which is interesting because all Apple Pay is a credit card, a different interface for your credit card. Apple Pay isn't actually a lender. They're just providing a new function for that. I've seen a lot of people get that one wrong. But what is Starbucks? Starbucks is letting you upload your funds once into a digital wallet and then spend it down. In that process, they're saving a lot of swipe fees. So say you upload $50. They get paid one swipe fee on your $50. Instead of doing that 10 times for coffee, if it's 50, 40 cents a swipe, they save $4. They give you one free coffee. That probably costs them 40 cents. They've made a killing. A lot of people think that this is a loyalty play or something about the float that they're going to earn on your money. And that there is some of that. I mean, there's $1 billion sitting there. But it's really a system about changing the economics. And this is where I want to go. Now, I'm going to use a specific, and the numbers of this vary by your payment instrument. But I'm going to focus on the upper income payment cards because this is why I think the American system is going to continue to dominate in the U.S. And the Chinese system, despite its pros and cons, will not. And it has to do with this kind of transaction. So you buy something for $100. The merchant ends up with about $95. This is probably a pretty nice credit card, right? Your card gives you 1% cash back. So I've gotten $1. Things actually cost me $99. There's a little money that goes into the various different banks that are providing the service. The merchant gets $95, right? The consumer, in addition to getting a dollar back, probably has a month without having to pay interest, on the $100, a nice grace period to help them manage their own cash flow, their own float, et cetera, and so forth. So the consumer in the U.S. situation is benefiting. The merchant gets a series of value propositions, universal acceptance, not having to handle cash, not having to do all these transactions. But the merchant pays an amount for it. And the credit card processor in the middle makes some money, has to handle some fraud risk, has to handle some security and identification example. So let's go back to China. In the Chinese system, the money basically moves through with very, very little amount going out. The only place where the money is going to go out is if the digital wallet downstreams it and it doesn't exist within the ecosystem, it goes down. It's hard to get exact data. When you look online, they talk about, I used 1%, they talk about 0.1%, but then there are usually some other fees attached to that, and I wouldn't take that number exactly. Either way, it's a much, much lower cost of transaction from the merchant's perspective. From the customer's perspective, they're getting no cash back on the elite end, and they've had to pre-fund this $100. There's no 30-day grace period. It's a very different system in its simplicity and its benefits and cost. Okay. So let me pause for a second because I'm going through a lot and throwing a lot at you. But what I want to get, if you're going to walk away with one kind of, 20,000 foot thought, because it's Brookings and you wanted to think something big here, right? We in America have a divide between banking and commerce. It's in our law, right? What's Mitsubishi? It's not a car, hint, it's not a car company. It's one of the largest banks in the world, right? In America, we differentiate the two. And we segregate in this line. We've never really thought, where's payments? Why? Because payments have always been part of the banking system, because the banking system inherently has been able to provide that efficiently and effectively and with broad and wired adoption. We have a series of legal and regulatory structures that assume banking payments are part of banking. But the legal separation does not place payments in the banking system. It's relatively silent. The banking system is about taking deposits, having insurance, making loans. It's not about processing payments. And if the U.S. payment system were to migrate away from the banking system, a large measure of consumer protection and regulatory oversight would migrate away with that within our existing legal structure. And we've not thought through this. There are also concerns you might have about banks in terms of their profitability in the system and in terms of what's to happen in the financial stability. Because again, because of our regulatory and government insurance, right, you're pretty confident that your money's in your bank, no matter what happens to your bank. What happens to your digital wallet if one day there's a security breach, there's this, there's that? Our system hasn't thought about that because we've assumed the digital wallet is ultimately somewhere in the banking system. China showed that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. In addition, there's some concerns about what happens from a competitive nature. To go back to this slide, remember, I now have an incentive as the merchant to buy things using my digital wallet. I think this is where you're going to find some of the growth in China, which is digital wallet companies providing services to merchants, payroll processing, all these other things. Currently, it's kind of rare to pay your employees through this. But now it's cheaper for me than to downstream to my bank and buy off platform. This raises some competition and privacy questions. It raises some data questions. It raises a series of other competitive concerns that don't exist in the banking construct because banking doesn't have those other ancillary issues because they've been separated broadly from commerce. So in the last minute I have, as I summarize, first, Chinese payments are going global. This is from Japan. You're going to see Alipay and WeChat Pay more in the U.S. You're going to see it where tourists go, here in Washington, at luxury hotels, in New York, in Las Vegas, in Disney World. You're going to start seeing adoption far more, and it's going to flow. Just like when we go overseas, we almost expect without thinking that there's going to be a place that takes our card. They're going to think that there's going to be a place that takes their QR code. However, it's unlikely to catch on in America with American consumers. For the wealthy who are well served by the existing system, with the merchants who have some costs of putting the money in their digital wallet system, creating a QR scanning code, replacing their existing system, consumer behavior is very tricky, right? How many people here enjoy the process of chip and sign where you get to wait longer in your terminal for putting your card in? But has it stopped you? Has it changed how you pay? And the existing regulatory system provides a series of well-thought-through protections that are not necessarily extended. But should it change, we're not well prepared. With that, I thank you guys very much. I'm happy to take some questions from the audience and go back. And if you could just give your name, who you're with, and ask a question. It's the only three things I ask. Yes. And if you have... over there. And then the second mic, if you could get to that guy right by the door, we'll go more quickly. Is the mic, could you, you can have a mic, but it can't work.
Okay. If you looked at the sort of local economy perspectives of things and small merchants across Asia, there's a, you know, really vivid dynamic there, which is also captured by this. So whilst I understand why you don't think it's going to come to America, I think it's going to keep on going everywhere else that wants local economies to thrive.
So there's definitely lessons to learn on this, and certainly in China, but you also have to ask the question, in external countries in Asia, right, there are some digital wallets that are growing up, but they're competing against more well-established banking systems in Korea, in Japan, that have a set of card-based and adoption and point-of-sale terminals. I think where you're likely to find more adoption are places like China that started from ground zero and have a different system. You could have a QR-based system that still is through the banking system. What's unique in China is the large amount of disintermediation that's gone out of the banking system that may be replicated in some other countries, but I think it may not in many. Sir, in the back, and then we'll come up front.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. I'm Henry Tugendhat. I'm a PhD student at SAIS Johns Hopkins across the road, and I work on China-Africa financial relations. And so I was interested in your talk, particularly in the perspective of when I've done fieldwork in Nigeria and Kenya, if you stay in Chinese hotels, they will often allow you to pay for your hotel stay in Nairobi or Abuja or wherever. By paying in QR if you have a WeChat account in renminbi. And obviously that's great from their perspective because it means they don't have to lose money when they're converting money back into renminbi. But I'm very curious as to how the regulation of this works because I imagine in the African context there's going to be a lack of regulation around this.
So, right.
Whereas in China it must be very well developed.
So... in terms of the regulatory state overseas, I don't know. In terms of the paper, I'm hoping I'm better balancing the amount of research done on China versus M-Pesa to the dollar transactions that are occurring between the two because I think there's a huge disagreement. The regulation of digital wallets in the U.S. is something that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau had. They promulgated what I thought was a pretty good initial rule that would have extended the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, or EFTA, which is the regulatory construct, and brought it under digital wallets, and I think that's the right answer. It was brought under prepaid cards. Before that, there were large amounts of consumer abuse, particularly in the prepaid card space. I've been disappointed at the current CFPB leadership, which kind of has the idea that even if the last group solved a problem well, because the last group solved it, that they need to do it differently. And I'm concerned that they've put out that they may change or rescind that part of the prepaid card. I think you need a level playing field, and this is why I'm concerned if we don't level the playing field and provide those same protections. If this thing goes off and viral in the U.S., it could end up poorly. There's a woman in the second row.
Hi, Kay Turner at Treasury. Both Alibaba and Tencent had existing businesses to whom they sold payments. I was wondering, in a U.S. context, what the limitations were for large tech companies that have existing businesses to whom they sell payments. Given your point, if you could thread the needle about the limitations.
So the clear parallel is, you know, tomorrow it's widely rumored that Facebook is going to release a digital currency of its own to provide payment in intermediary. They've also, you know, purchased Venmo. Amazon obviously is the Alipay situation. there are networks in the U.S., social media, that have a clear economic incentive to try and reduce costs and enter into the provision of financial services. A generation ago, this debate got focused on Walmart and banking and the acquiring of an industrial loan corporation licensing. I think the future, but what I think people failed to appreciate was that was about the taking of deposits and triggered a series of banking. When you're thinking about the online context or the person-to-person payment, you're thinking about the payment system, and that can be done completely within the business of commerce. There's nothing special about our legal structure that precludes commercial companies from operating their own payment rails. Sir? And then I want to get some. Okay, go. You have the mic.
I was wondering about your thoughts on the Chinese system versus more of like the Swedish system, Swish, and how that's kind of received blowback for not discrimination, but difficulties with immigrants, refugees, and retirees, and whether that's a valid argument or if we are going to see more of a cashless system across Europe as well.
So I'm not so sure you're going to – Sweden is a little bit of a special case. One, it's a pretty homogenous population. I know that there are – it's not completely homogenous. Two, they have a high amount of government transfers. That's something in China. You're shocked that China has this system because they have so many bank accounts. One of the things that drew me to this project was – why would banks be disintermediated in payments in China given that they had 7 billion debit cards, right? I don't think you're seeing a cashless society in many places. I think actually my colleague Marcella likes to point out, as laws about migration change, the desire to pay in cash may grow. So the other situation you have here is on this digital divide issue, you don't need a phone to exist in this Alipay WeChat system. You need a piece of paper with a code printed out. So I think it's far more inclusive in that space. Sir, on the left, and I want to take somebody from the back.
Thank you. Carl Golovin. Doesn't this potentially really challenge the whole Western privately controlled central bank model of money being borrowed into existence at interest? Where it seems
there's no borrowing in this system. It's all pre-funded.
Okay. So in essence,
that's another core distinction. We think when you buy something on a credit card, you're borrowing. When you buy something on a debit card, you're not. And this is all on a prepaid system. It does challenge, and I'm a little bit worried about central banks because they believe they have to control the payment system because it's been part of the banking system. Maybe.
How might this have a relationship even with the potential for digital or blockchain related gold-based monies in circulation.
So let me. I think using gold shavings for transacting money is silly. Sir, right there in the back. Yep.
James from Research 137. I have a question about your thesis of disintermediation because I have Alipay and I never gave money to Alibaba because it always takes money from
direct
my
pull.
Debit card.
Direct yeah. pull.
So of the $50 trillion you surveyed or you cited, how much is that is directly from debit cards, not going through Ali or WeChat?
Well, so it does go through because they're pulling it direct. So what you have to be clear is, why isn't this, I thought I had this up here. Can we get this back up here? I guess not. I went back to the original Chinese payment slide. It's over there for some reason. So the point there is that you direct pull from your – there you go. So you're just direct pulling. So you're not leaving money there. In fact, a lot of people actually use their digital wallet and then go to ancillary services, a money market fund, another place to get interest because the digital wallet itself doesn't bring interest. They're direct pulling. There's actually a fee in that situation, but Alipay is paying that fee. So the bank is extracting a fee as the $100 goes upstreamed on the far side there. But Alipay is paying that back because they want to promote you spending money on that ecosystem. There is a disintermediation because it goes from one digital wallet to another. There are two banks in this picture. In this picture, there are three. So I've just cut out one of the two banks. Right there. And then I hope you have – I'm going to – this is the speed round because I only have time for one more question, so I'm going to take a couple at once, and the best one wins.
Carl Pulser, a Center on Capital and Social Equity. So in the non-fee part of this China system, there's a lot of stuff going on and there's services being provided. That has to be paid for. So in a sense, they're sort of reinsuring these individual wallets. They're doing a lot of transactions for these sub-accounts. And what if there's fraud? I mean, what if somebody steals my code? What's the organization that's assuming all that risk, and how do they make their money?
Right. Dan. And Chuck.
Dan Murphy, Milken Institute. Sort of an open-ended question here. You mentioned the float before. My understanding is that the Chinese Central Bank requires 100% of the float be kept at the central bank of some of these platforms. So I just wonder if you have any general thoughts on that or some of the other systemic issues that might come out of any of that and how it maybe should be regulated.
Great. And Chuck, last word.
So you effectively argued that I'm better off on the American system. Where on the demographic economic scale does it flip and U.S. people are better off under the Chinese system?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. And I've thought a lot about that, and I wish I had a really crisp answer for it, because part of the Chinese system involves the money to be there, either pre-funded in your account or pull-funded from your account. And it depends how much you value the ability to get that level of credit and then what the terms and cost are of that credit. And it's not entirely clear. I think the merchants, by and large, are better on the Chinese system. However, the economics on the Chinese system begin to become a little bit intriguing when you realize that the platforms are going to get a tremendous amount of control and incentive about how you purchase, from whom you purchase, and how your situation moves, right? Right now, if you're a merchant, you say, oh, you know, I don't like the terms of my bank, I'm going to switch banks. That's not going to change how you show up in a Google query about where you want to go or what business. About the people, it's an interesting question. The day labor is probably in cash. Let me, for Dan, you've clearly read page 11 of the report, which doesn't surprise me, where we talk about originally the Chinese government started with requiring 20% reserving and then 50% and then 100%, which they thought was going to be $1 billion a year in annual interest. But part of that had to do with the point the gentleman in front of you said about money situation. If the digital wallet's only reserving a fair less than 100%, then the digital wallet is creating money. When the digital wallet has full reserving, then there's no money creation. So I think I'm now 2 minutes over, so I'm going to turn to the panel, and if you guys could come and take your seat, and I'll introduce David. David Dollar is a senior fellow in Brookings and the head of our China Center. And when David and I served together at the Treasury, he was the point person for the U.S. China economic relationship in the government. Besides that, he's had a distinguished career in a variety of other ways. And for those of you who don't subscribe to his podcast, Dollars and Cents, you are missing out. So whatever you do, as David, before you leave here, subscribe to that podcast and you will learn a lot.
Okay. Thank you very much, Aaron. Please, you join our panel as well. So Aaron's given us a lot of interesting food for thought, and we have a great panel to explore in more detail. Immediately to my left is Claudia Biancotti, who's a senior economist at the Bank of Italy and visiting the Peterson Institute across the street. Frank Toscano is a senior manager at the Royal Caribbean Cruises, which have started taking Alipay and WeChat Pay on some of their cruises. So he's going to give us a perspective from the real world of business. Huang Yiping has many titles, including Deputy Dean of the National School of Development at Peking University and a leading expert on Chinese finance. You've already met Aaron. So actually, Yiping, I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
You just arrived from Beijing last night, I know, so give you a chance to talk before you get tired.
Okay.
One of the things Aaron's report emphasizes is the issue of financial inclusion. And it's pretty dramatic, you know, going around China, seeing how these electronic payments are used. So can you go a little bit more detail about inclusion? Is it really reaching pretty much everybody in China? And how do you see that?
Well, as Aaron's
numbers show that each of the major service providers, WeChat Pay and Alipay, has around 1 billion active customers. That just shows how popular it has become. But I think the real story why it started was, in fact, most of them didn't have any option of a payment. On both sides, on the one hand, as you said earlier, there are lots of debit cards around, but lots of people actually don't have access to that service. On the other hand, I think what really makes it popular now and inclusive is that, in fact, most of the street side stores don't have any means of payment. So that's why I think the reason why it became successful is really not just the payment system itself, but the ecosystem around it. So basically, I mean, I nowadays can live just with my mobile phone. I can order my lunchbox, buy my air tickets, and pay my electricity bills. Almost you can do everything, whether on WeChat Pay and Alipay, and I think that makes things very attractive. I met some people when I made field trips to the rural areas, and there are people there. In fact, some of them have a bank account, some of them don't. But many of them, like, it's a very remote area. So once you have this, this is the only thing you could have. We have a very nice map to show. We have the Peking University Digital Financial Inclusion Index to just measure the level of digital finance in different municipalities. And you find in 2011, the coastal area was leading, but the inland provinces was really lagging. But in 2018, and we have a number for every year, 7 years later, the color converged quite significantly. The lagging region is catching up very, very significantly. Finally, we also have done some studies to show the impact of adoption of the payment, mobile payment services on ordinary people, and we found a number of very interesting findings. Number one, adoption of the mobile payment actually promotes the establishment of new registered businesses, which means it's very useful for people to start new businesses once you adopt this. And the second, similarly, we use household survey data. You also find the farmers, after they adopt the mobile payment service, are much more likely to become informal or formal business operators, and their income levels rise. So these are just the evidences you find, and they have real impact, not just to make people's life easier, but also promote economic development.
So one of the questions that already came up was sort of thinking about the U.S., sort of what's the, what's the cutoff point of the income distribution, in a sense, you know, below which you're not really getting served by the U.S. system you might be better off. So can I ask any of the other panelists, or Yiping, if you happen to know, so what would you do if you're down at that bottom of the U.S. distribution? You know, what is the reality of payments down there? And, you know, how costly is it compared to this Chinese system?
I mean, I'd say it's very expensive to be poor. And I would say that, you know, we have 7% of America that's unbanked. Those people are spending money for wire transmissions, other money orders, payments. 20% of Americans are underbanked. They have a bank account, but they're paying other things. Americans spent $35 billion a year in overdraft fees last year. The average family that overdrafted had three a month. And so if you're a heavy overdraft user, about three a month, that's $1,200 a year. That's how expensive for things that are basically free for the top 40%.
So Yiping, Aaron emphasized how in the United States, if you're at the high end of the income distribution,
right,
there are a lot of benefits.
Right.
Do you have similar benefit? Do high-end Chinese using Alipay have similar?
We probably do. In fact, when I heard you talking about the comparison between the Chinese payment system and the American payment system, it's a very similar story when we compare the banking payment system in China and the non-banking payment system. You find that the banks very slow and very lazy, but because they capture a fat profit. But the Alipay and WeChat Pay starting the businesses because they start from nowhere and they had to serve these poor people. So I'm probably a little bit less pessimistic than you are about the possibility of these mobile payments spreading around. If you say, well, 10%, 20% of the population not well-serviced, then I think potentially there is a way of doing it. Even in China, for instance, these payment services are so widespread now, they still only account for 8.8% of the value, of the payment value. It's a small number, but in terms of volume, they're already 77% because every transaction is so much smaller than the bank payment. But they still make huge money because with the technology, the platform, the so-called long tail, once you set up the system, you can serve whatever amount of customers is there, the marginal cost is almost zero. So I think if that is potentially also applicable, then there is an option, a probability that this system could also spread. But I can't just say for sure this will definitely happen. Whether if it's for Alipay or for WeChat Pay, it happened to some extent. It was accidental. So for instance, the WeChat Pay, why it suddenly spread? Well, obviously you had a good system, ecosystem around. But the reason why it started was the red packet. I myself was not very enthusiastic about these electronic payments. But I started with the WeChat Pay about 3 or 4 years ago during the Chinese New Year. People all sending out the red packet. And for quite a while, I didn't really hit the button. But then it was for so long, and I hit the button, and I thank somebody who distributed the money. And then somebody spotted and said, oh, Professor Huang is also in the group. Why don't you send around some money? So I tried to link it up with my bank account, but I just immediately would delink my bank account from the WeChat account. But after 3 times, just get used to it, and I'm now been on for a very long time.
Just to add to that, David, I think one of the things that really led to widespread adoption was, in China, they had a quantum leap in technology that dovetailed really nicely with the burgeoning middle class expansion in China. So they largely went from an analog society to really advanced smartphone technology overnight. They skipped the laptops that many of us are still tethered to, and that was really one of the things that that made the platform pop the way it has.
Okay, thanks.
Platforms.
Claudia, I want to turn to you. I want to ask you about data privacy and data ownership issues. So I know you're thinking about and writing about the data issues in general and how Europe, the U.S., China are all developing different standards. It's an issue in this particular topic, you know, who owns the data? And we can hear from Yiping a little bit about China, but I wanted to talk to you first, okay?
Sure. So I think that if we want to understand fully what data protection issues are involved in this story of mobile payments, we should be looking at TikTok. And, you know, TikTok is a Chinese app, and if any of you has teenagers at home, you will know about it because it's very popular with teens. And last year, it was more downloaded than Facebook Messenger, Instagram, WhatsApp. And, you know, so far, it's only popular in this niche demographic of teens and young adults. And this is true in the U.S., this is true in Europe. And I totally concur with what Aaron was saying in his report when he says WeChat and Alipay are not going to take off in the U.S. because they don't have the networks, because Americans are on Facebook, they're on Instagram, they're not on WeChat, so they don't see the appeal of having a payment instrument integrated into a social network they don't use. But what if TikTok tomorrow added a payment feature that was widely appealing? If I understand correctly, you already can exchange coins within TikTok. It's not linked to the banking system, as far as I know, in the US and Europe. But it gives the idea that if you ever had Chinese social media outlet that gets popular in the US and takes off for the general population, then you could have a payment system within it that's also linked to the banking system. And so which kind of issues of data protection does this raise? And I wanted to lead off with a concrete example, because it's actually happening. I mean, it might be tomorrow that an app like that appeals to a broader demographic. So right now, the situation will be quite different in Europe and the US. Because in Europe, there have been a lot of efforts fielded to develop a so-called digital rights model. And in 2018, you had the General Data Protection Regulation come into effect. This is a very strict data protection regime that embraces all of the European Union's member countries. And what is important about this is that this piece of legislation has extraterritorial scope, meaning that when a company harvests data on European citizens, it cannot export this data anywhere except if the receiving jurisdiction offers the same data protection guarantees as the EU. And if that is not the case, there must be specific contractual agreements assuring European citizens that their data are going to be kept private, confidential, only used for the purpose they were explicitly collected for. So, you know, in theory, no data can be exported to China. I'm saying in theory because this legislation is only 1 year old. There has not been any major case involving a Chinese company. The one major case has involved Google, which was fined, by the way. But the European legal system and the Chinese legal system are structurally at odds when it comes to data protection. Because in Europe, the law says I cannot send you data if you don't offer the same guarantees. And the Chinese law says the government must be able to access any data collected by private companies. And you can't have this together. And actually, before this problem existed with China, it existed between the EU and the US. Actually, one of the reasons why the EU has such a strict data protection regulation is because European legislators wanted to make sure that there would be no mass espionage on the part of the NSA. So basically, that's actually sorry. That's actually what brought about, in part, this whole reflection about privacy. So right now there is a very strict agreement between the EU and the US, and only under certain conditions can European data go to the US. There is no agreement of this type with China. So if a payment processor which collects a lot of data from China was ever to become popular in Europe, you would probably need the two governments to sit down and negotiate a data privacy agreement. Is that possible with China's national security law compelling government access to privately collected data? This is probably not possible, but it's going to be a big deal. So this is where the incompatibility of the legal systems is absolutely evident because of this privacy law with an extraterritorial scope. With the US, it's a bit more unclear. So what if TikTok were to become popular with all of the population and people started using it to pay their bills, maybe in partnership with WeChat or with Alibaba? This is not clear because the US does not have a federal privacy law with extraterritorial scope. So in that sense, commercially, it would be easier for TikTok to become a payment processor in the US. And kind of paradoxically, the US will be more exposed to both the privacy risks and, more importantly, the security risks that go with that. So it's a very fluid situation, I'd say, when it comes to data protection.
Right, so that sounds like a pretty serious impediment. I mean, how realistic is it to actually enforce these regulations?
Well, I believe that enforcement will have to build on technology. In the relationships between the EU and Google, you can take Google to court, right? It's possible because you have international cooperation in this arena as well. that European authorities could audit the operations of Google even outside of the EU. I don't see that happening with China. I don't see the Chinese authorities granting a European court the possibility to audit the operations of TikTok or Alipay or Tencent in China. So in that case, either you manage to find some kind of self-enforcing technology whereby users have a transparent view of what is being doing with their data, and there is a lot of research on this right now, but it's not commercially viable yet, or I guess it's probably going to be to fail. Like, there's probably going to be a commercial divide when it comes to anything that needs personal data to work, which is pretty much anything. So, yeah.
Yiping, can I ask you about the data privacy, data ownership issue? Is it clear in China? Is there a discussion about this?
Well, there are certainly lots of discussions. And I think a part of the reason why the fintech industry developed so quickly is because there's no serious law protecting privacy. But I think the real question it raises is, I think this is a challenge for everybody, not just China, how to balance between the benefit of big data analysis and the protection of privacy. Just to say, I mean, I think it's pretty clear privacy is not well protected. So, for instance, if I buy a car in the morning, in the afternoon, I will receive at least a dozen of short messages about car-related services. The problem means my phone number was sent was either sold or sent shared with somebody. So this is a bigger problem we needed to look at. But at the same time, I just also want to share with you some of the things they're doing. Actually, it becomes hugely beneficial. So for instance, you all know there is a bigger problem about if providing credit to SMEs, small, medium enterprises, because traditionally the banking sector would assess credit risk, only look at either the historical data or look at your fixed assets as collateral or look at the implicit government guarantees. SMEs don't have any. That's why they're all struggling for a very long time. The government has been trying for 6-7 years. I don't think there is a significant turnaround in that situation. Just give you one example. Alibaba has a bank, online bank in Hangzhou. It's called My Bank. It's online, so they don't have any branches across the countries. And they have about 600 staff in one single office. Every year now, at the moment, they are serving something like 7 to 8 million SMEs every single year. Without even seeing the customers, what they call the 310 model. It took 3 minutes for the customer to fill in the application for the loan. 1 second, the money is into your account. There's no human interference into the process. The only reason why my bank can do that is because they look at your data and they pre-approved an amount of loan for you. So I think the big data can really do a lot of things, especially to help the poor. But again, I think balancing the two is something we needed to work on.
So let me jump in, because that's been huge in the U.S. context, because what you've seen is a new linkage form between payment processing and the provision of credit. Square Capital and PayPal have kind of led the way in this. And let me just give a couple facts. In the U.S. context, a bank often wanted to see 3 years of transaction flows for a small business. So here's who's not eligible. Any small business that hasn't been in business for 3 years. Now, in a cash flow basis, you could do it 3 months. If one of these places has seen your 3 month cash flow, they have a pretty good idea as to what your loan will be, and they'll make the loan immediately on your 310 model. But here's the catch, and this is true, I'll do Square. You pay back on the basis of each swipe that goes through the payment processing. And one of the benefits of it is, in fact, they don't actually have a fixed-term loan. You want to borrow $10,000, you pick your daily swipe fee between 3 to 5%, and 3 to 5% off the top goes back to paying back your loan, right? They'll forecast, and they'll say, at 3%, you have to pay us back $11,000, at 5%, you have to pay us back $10,500. you can't actually calculate an APR, which is our common form of interest rate and consumer disclosure regulation, because an APR assumes a term of a loan. Because what bank makes a loan without knowing the term? But because it's on payment processing. The second conflict on that is that while the loan is technically unsecured, it's actually first in line in the creditor queue. Why? Because every day and every swipe, at the end of the day, that money's going right back to your loan before you're getting access to it. So if you have a secured loan or you think you have a secured loan anywhere else on the loan hierarchy to that business, you've been leapfrogged by the payment processor. Square is able to do this and still not be a bank because they've raised private capital under Square Capital to do that type of lending. Right? Eventually, and they're starting to apply for this, they need to eventually change that model to get another source of capital. But this relinking of payment processing has a huge upside to reach more small business, but raises a set of other legal and regulatory questions that in the U.S. context have not been well addressed.
Okay, thanks. Frank, I'm going to turn to you. And Lexter, your company has started accepting Alipay, WeChat Pay for certain transactions. So I think it'd be good to get a little reality of why you made that decision. What does it actually involve? What are the benefits? What are the costs?
Sure. No. So thanks. As Aaron very correctly asserts in his paper, consumers tend to spend more, roughly to the tune of 77%, using a form of mobile payment than they have in the two previous years that they've taken a vacation or they've gone abroad. And so that really struck a chord with us, along with really the way that the red packet system and the way that it took off almost immediately. That led us into thinking, how can we evolve our payment systems on our vessels, on our ships? And it's important to set the context of the business we work in. So these are cruise ships from a multinational company that are based and service mainland Chinese guests. There are three ships currently in the region in China. And on these ships, the demographic is close to 97% to 98% mainland Chinese and 2%, 3% in international mix. So given that breakdown, it made a lot of sense. But the thing that we look at most is, apart from the safety and security of our guests and crew members, as you would imagine, when you operate a business in the ocean, almost entirely, apart from our private island destinations and the terminals, that's your number one concern. Secondarily to that would be the guest experience. So what guest experience means is, okay, are you having a great time, and how likely are you to promote us to a friend, a family member, a colleague, to say, hey, come sail with us? And that's really what we looked at, was the guest experience. We didn't look at any financial or monetary benefit or gain. We said, how can we improve this? If we offer a seamless, frictionless payment system in addition and alongside with the China UnionPay cup debit and credit forms of payment, and along with all the international credit cards that we accept, and along with the cash, you stick the China mobile platforms, you line them up with that. And then what you're saying essentially is, we're happy to take whatever payment you're willing to use, and we're going to make it easy, and we're going to make it very fast. Because when you're on vacation, you don't want to spend your time calculating the interest rate that your bank's going to charge you, or the concern with these things. You want to go on the surf simulator, or climb a rock wall, or go on bumper cars. So what we found was, Let's deploy Alipay first. We followed very closely with WeChat Pay. It was a tremendous hit. We deployed it at all the retail venues throughout the ship. Many of you that have cruised know, there's a lot of shopping to do. There's a lot to buy, and so we did it at the spa, the retail, and then it quickly evolved and migrated to the food and beverage outlets as well. And it really stuck. It really resonated with our guests, so much so that, based on the success of the region, we deployed it to ships. Chinese tourism is massive. Chinese mainlanders are traveling all over, so Caribbean, Europe, Alaska. So we've put a scaled-down footprint in those markets, on the ships in those markets and those regions as well. So with a fleet of 46 ships, you start to say, well, what are the economics behind this project that was launched? Sure, it was successful from a guest satisfaction perspective, but what does it look like as a merchant? So number one, the low fees are massive. So we're talking about three or four times the basis points that we would pay with traditional forms of payment. It's three or four times less of a cost. Mm. Secondly, there's repair and maintenance, very expensive point-of-sale terminals. And I think with point-of-sale terminals essentially on their way to extinction nearly in China, I think there are 34 million point-of-sale terminals in the entire country of China at the end of 2018 and probably decreasing. How can we put out hardware that's cheap, easy to use, easy to upgrade, easy to scale? It's a tenth of the cost hardware-wise. It's a lot easier to repair and maintain. You don't have to upgrade it every time chip is added, combined with signature, and you have all these variations of chip, swipe, magnetic stripe, and signature. We don't have to do those updates any longer. And then thirdly, and this is the most difficult one to pinpoint, and it's really around the incremental revenue that we're seeing as a result of these forms of payments. We'd like to have access to more of the data. So it's really not an equitable share of data at this point. Mm-hmm. We have a transaction ID. We have a dollar amount for the item or the service that was purchased. But we aren't able to directly correlate that in a meaningful way that allows us to effectively market the products to the right person at the right time in the right location. Because also what the WeChat platform affords is the ability to do that type of marketing directly to the consumer while they're on the ship. So we can not only leverage the WeChat platform and to some extent the Alipay platform to accept it as a form of payment, but we can also take that a step further and say, all right, well, so you're using location services, and not to be too creepy about it, but using location-based services, okay, you just walk by the spa. Well, here's a coupon to use the spa, and by the way, you can pay using it, right? It's a vacation. You want to have a good time. We want to enable that for you. So that's really how it came to pass and how we ended up offering it on Royal Caribbean. Some of the things that keep me up at night, probably I share with the rest of the panelists on the stage here, and that's really around the data protection and how do we get ahead of that. We've taken an approach where it's the long pole in the tent. Let's try to adhere to GDPR as one of the most stringent policies globally. Mm. And you know, with China and from an outsider as a representative for a multinational organization working with China, we receive an announcement that there's going to be a data protection policy that's going to be issued, and this is what it's going to look like. And then I think that's a little bit different from the enforcement of that announcement. So different things, but we've been extremely, extremely cautious in terms of data protection because clearly that's a risk that any business can't afford to take. And in terms of, I'm sorry, David, one more point. In terms of deployment, the technology itself is simplistic. Quick response codes have been around for ages. Mm-hmm. Smartphones have been around, you know, since 2005, roughly, when the first iPhone came out. So we're talking about a decade, decade and a half of the technology existing. The most challenging piece was really a contractual agreement and building trust between a company based in China and a multinational company based in Miami, Florida, for us specifically.
Right, Frank, so as I understand from talking to you earlier, you're pricing these services and goods in dollars.
That's correct.
Right? Your Chinese tourists have Alipay, WeChat Pay accounts tied to their Chinese Yuan bank accounts, right? So there's a foreign exchange issue, which I find interesting. So can you say a little bit about how that works?
Certainly, David. So, the onboard currency on all cruise ships within our brands, our umbrella of brands, is U.S. dollars. So there's an exchange rate, and guests and our guests and consumers are incentivized based on their loyalty tier within the Alipay and WeChat Pay framework. So based on your tier, you're offered a more advantageous exchange rate. So that's about collecting money. The money is converted by the platforms, the tech platforms, into USD on our ships. That money is then in turn taken, and in the case of Alibaba, we work with Ant Financial. So Ant Financial will then again reconvert that money. We'll actually take that money and repatriate it for us. So there's cross-border payments, and they will deposit that money in a bank account. There are a couple locations in the APAC region that we use that will handle it in USD.
Okay. So one of the rules for lawyers is never ask a question to which you do not know the answer. So, but I guess there's different rules for moderators. So I don't know if anyone knows. So is there a limit, Yiping, you maybe you know, or Frank, is there a limit, kind of an annual limit on the extent to which you could use your Alipay or your WeChat Pay abroad?
Altogether, I don't think there is an explicit limit. There might be. But usually the limit is if you can't transfer money more than 10,000 a day.
Right, but would that occur for these, would that be relevant for these purchases, which are basically current account transactions?
You mean overseas?
Yeah, so, you know.
Well, overseas, in theory, it's the same current account management. The regulation is that everybody can spend no more than $50,000.
Okay, per year.
Per year, right. Yeah.
And that's aligned with the contracts that we negotiated as well.
So you can't buy the $100,000 Rolex?
Well, there's a workaround for that.
You have to do it together, together with your wife.
It's two transactions. It's back to back. So it's handled.
Aaron, I wanted to ask you, I think you mentioned that Facebook is going to be launching a so-called cryptocurrency tomorrow. I read that it's going to be linked to a basket of currencies, so I'm not sure to what extent it's a cryptocurrency, but it certainly has the potential to become this kind of payment system. So based on your prediction, are you suggesting this is going to be a failure?
No, I think I'm going to let me disaggregate kind of three things within the prediction. One is the adoption of QR codes could very well occur, right? We've adopted barcodes. We could move into a QR payment system. Right, you're seeing people try to become smarter. Remember the garage example I had of how you just scan the QR code? Right, so now anybody here parks at Dulles, you actually put this credit card in and the credit card out, it gets rid of the little thing. That's great as long as you remember which card you came in with, right? Because most people have multiple cards in their wallet. The QR system, I think, could well get adopted. The mobile wallets, digital wallets, in the U.S., it's still ultimately a bank-centric model. The digital wallet is ultimately part of the banking system and the banking experience. Apple Pay is not disintermediating the banks. They're layering on top, right? In the Facebook example, and there needs to be more information out about this, when I transact in Facebook currency, is there a bank underlying between that, or is it two digital wallets within the Facebook ecosystem? If it's two digital wallets within the Facebook ecosystem, it may have a place. It may have a place in international money transmission. Right? There's 7 million Americans who live part of the year abroad. They may want to transact in that currency within their social network in a multinational context. There are many other people all around the world that are more global who may want to settle in different things. At some point, there could be a play where multinational companies have interest in Frank's house. Rather than pricing everything globally in dollars, wants to price everything globally in a different currency. In that area, that could be fine. And it could take off. It could not. I don't know. What it's not going to do is replace the credit card. What it's not going to do is replace the debit card as a general means of transaction, particularly on the higher-end credit spectrum.
Claudia, I want to ask you a central bank question, coming from Bank of Italy. So are there central bank worries about these developments? Is there a problem with the conduct of monetary policy? If Aaron's wrong and this new Facebook currency takes off very quickly in the U.S. and Europe, what is there for central banks to worry about?
So details on the Facebook currency right now are very sparse, and I'm actually very much looking forward to reading the white paper tomorrow. But what I understand is that the plan is to have this coin that is actually minted by Facebook, and its value will be pegged, as you said, to a basket of currencies. And the crypto part comes in how transactions are secured, because they are going to be secured on a blockchain, so through cryptography. The point is, right now we don't know anything about how many of these coins are going to exist, who is going to set their growth rate or their non-growth rate, as it were. And I guess that understanding these details is extremely important, because potentially this looks like currency that will be spent in something like 100 countries. We've never seen that before. And it was already quite problematic to set up the euro, which, you know, it started with far less than 100 countries. And you have all sorts of issues with monetary policy and fiscal policy when you create a monetary area. Of course, you cannot do that without the approval of regulators. You cannot have private currency. I mean, you technically can in some countries, like the German law allows for private currency in certain settings. And of course, you can have your own thing with your friends, but you cannot call it currency until there is an obligation for merchants to accept it, which is like legal tender. The point with Facebook is that Facebook is so big. You know, with Bitcoin, there was, of course, worry in the central banking community about whether it will impact monetary policy and financial stability. But in the end, the bottom line was it's not a big issue because Bitcoin is small. And so as long as it stays small, you don't have any problem of, what's happening in the Bitcoin market affecting the exchange rate between the dollar and the euro. Now, with a Facebook coin potentially used by 2 billion users, you could have these feedback effects. You could have, demand for this global coin, as it's supposed to be called, explode so much that it has an effect on the exchange rate of fiat. I mean, anything could happen because it's huge and it's going to be so hugely transnational. Right now, we don't know what it's going to be about. I mean, my personal prediction is that Facebook doesn't want to get into trouble with regulators and they don't want to get into trouble with the Bank for International Settlements. They're not making a bid for having their currency become legal tender, at least for now. So they're going to start very slow and negotiate with regulators. And this is going to have to be like controlled. This is going to have to be a controlled process. But, I mean, we'll know tomorrow. So.
I'm not sure we'll know tomorrow, but we'll know more tomorrow. I think we can turn now to questions from the audience. This gentleman with his hand up, do we have a microphone? So please just tell us who you are and ask a question.
It's Carl again. I identified myself before. So with Alipay, who owns the money in the packet? And is it my money still as a consumer? And what is Alipay, if Alipay doesn't own it, what's their fiduciary obligation to handling the money? How is that regulated? And how enforceable, is that fiduciary duty? Example. So another thing I can do, so I go to China, and I have $9,000 to travel, and I haven't bought a ticket home. I thought I bought a little red book that was in, I have one actually from the Swedish embassy in 1968, an original one. It was supposed to be $800, but the vendor actually took $8,000. And it kind of cheated me because I don't understand this Chinese renminbi stuff. And now I can't get home. So will Alibaba or Alipay help me as the credit card company would help me with a dispute with the vendor?
Right, so your more general question is about fraud, right? And there was already a question asked which wasn't answered. So, Aaron?
Yes, let me talk about this in the American context first, which is the Electronic Funds Transfer Act secures your rights with respect to your bank. So when you use the term credit card company is a great explanation that people don't fully understand that you do not have a relationship with Visa. Right, you have a relationship with the bank. The bank is not your credit. You think of the bank as your credit card company, but what the bank is a bank with a bank regulation and under bank law who's extended you a loan in your revolving credit card, and that's why that's covered under a debit card structure. Right? The CFPB originally proposed to extend that to a digital wallet structure. So you currently have this exact problem. How many people here have PayPal? Right now. How many people here have a PayPal balance, money in their PayPal account? So the rule about this issue is different if it's a PayPal balance than the other people who didn't raise their hand. You're just direct pulling your debit card through your PayPal. And your right of recourse is with your debit card at your bank under EFTA. What the CFPB structure said is we're going to treat those two things parallel because previously the law did not. And if that rule sets into place, then I think this problem that you're describing is covered. If the CFPB pulls it back, which they're talking about doing, because the rule came from the last crowd, so they've got to pull it back, right, without stopping and thinking, I think this will actually slow adoption. When you go back, for those of you, I'll close with this. The most cited, David made this comment about lawyers. The most cited economic theorem in law, as I understand it, is the Coase theorem, named for Ronald Coase, Nobel laureate. He said it doesn't matter. The government needs to assign property rights. If they're tradable, they can get out of the way. Under EFTA, the property right was that you're actually liable for the first $500. And this was set in the 70s, much closer to about $2,000 today, in or $1,500 in inflation. What's happened is, because they were tradable, the industry went, and in competing for your business, most folks in this room probably have zero liability. That's an offer that's given by the industry, because if they have to put in such a construct to remediate fraud against the tail risk event, they feel pretty good about covering the first couple $100 as well. And in that situation, it's created this great tradability. So I also get a little wary about places where you put in assigned liability without allowing any market mechanism, because it turned out $500 was not the market clearing amount of liability. Banks were willing to assume all of the liability, another benefit of having payments in the banking system.
Right. Now, do we know in the Chinese context, Yiping, have there been cases of fraud using either of these electronic
payments?
Two
things. If there is a fraud, Alipay, well, I think the same for the WeChat Pay. They're simply just paying for the money. At the moment, the probability, I mean, we just saw the number. For every 10 million yuan transaction, there was a risk, an average risk of 5 yuan. So Alipay simply is just paying for whatever. Their slogan is, as long as you're willing to pay, we're willing to cover whatever problems you incur. That's the policy, and it's going on for. I mean, I haven't heard any complaints about the major problems. The balance Aaron mentioned in the Alipay or WeChat Pay account, they used to be capped by the service providers. In fact, they deposit these money with the commercial bank and make a big interest income. But last year, the central bank changed its regulation. All money has to be deposited with the central bank with zero interest. So they complained a bit, but then there's nothing you could do about it. So
I can certainly support Yiping's statement in terms of the low availability or the low occurrence of fraud. We do have a refund process in place to address it. But what we've seen and our data shows is that it's in the low tenths of a percent in terms of when we actually have to process a refund on board our ships. So it's a very low occurrence, much lower than traditional forms of payment.
Right.
Other questions? This gentleman here.
Thank you so much for the panel. Mr. Toscano, I'll direct this to you.
Sure.
It seems like American vendors have a sort of very blinkered view of what and I'll take WeChat as a particular example, what WeChat can do. And I think the first time I saw a WeChat sort of QR code was like in a Las Vegas outlet mall or something. But they put it on the door like, we accept Visa, MasterCard, and WeChat. And I think that's where they think the value is. But I think it's, well, I know it's so much more than that. You know, as you mentioned, it's so integrated to the sort of social network. There's so much capability to upsell somebody. You know, if a hotel lets a Chinese consumer pay with their WeChat wallet, they can then sort of upsell them on the breakfast buffet when they walk by the restaurant or something. So I suppose my question is there, if sort of American vendors and merchants kind of knew the capabilities of what you could do with WeChat, of how, for example, when you send coupons to somebody, you're not just sending like a newsletter to somebody's spam box. You're literally sending it to their sort of WeChat queue, and they can see it just like you'll see a message in Facebook Messenger, for example. Do you think once people sort of know that and know how sort of integrated this is and how it's such an ecosystem that could sort of you know, serve as an impetus for more sort of adoption. I don't know if that's clear, but.
Well, in agreement with Aaron's position in the paper, I'd still say no. And the reason is ubiquity of the platform and the users within that platform domestically. And that's really where we're going to struggle from the, in the American context. But in terms of the unique niche that we have, which is a multinational with Chinese consumers, it's clearly it's almost endless possibilities. I mean, the capabilities are expansive, and those implications, as you stated, are far-reaching in terms of the marketing possibilities and the way people transact and trade, in essence, on these platforms.
This woman here.
Hi, thank you very much. I have a question about financial inclusion, and I want to thank Dr. Wang for sharing the statistics about how these payment systems have helped with SME growth. So my question is around gender, and do you actually have some of these statistics disaggregated by gender? Are these payment systems helping women entrepreneurs more than men entrepreneurs?
Can you give us your name? Thank you.
Oh, Patricia Langan. I'm with Save the Children. Thanks.
I'm so sorry. That should be a good question to have, but at the moment I don't. But I'm traveling with some colleagues from Ant Financial and my bank. I'll go back and check during dinner time. Maybe I'll send the numbers to David.
So I think on page 16 of the report,
you have.
I don't have it by gender, but this is not uncorrelated. Which is that according to the UN, the United Nations High Level Panel on Digital Cooperation, Alipay's more than half of their loans have gone to business owners under the age of 30. So it's not a disaggregation by gender, but. I'm going to guess there's an age-gender correlation. I'm going to guess younger people have a higher female percentage than, say, over the age of 60. That's just speculation. But
I should get that gentleman way in the back so we don't discriminate against the back.
Thank you. Hello, thank you. My name is Peter Nack. I'm at the School of Government at the University of Oxford and a visiting scholar at the Center for New Structural Economics at Beidou. My question is for Professor Huang. I followed the Digital Financial Inclusion Index, and it's very clear that China has moved the frontier, including many more people in both in transactions, payments, and credit. What I hear, having been in China last month, is that the discourse is moving away from maximize financial inclusion to make it commercially sustainable. NPL ratios have been rising. Henan province has 42 banks with NPL ratios over 5%. Do you think that China, having moved way beyond Western countries in financial inclusion, is hitting a frontier of how far it is commercially sustainable to extend credit to SMEs and other people?
Can I clarify? When you said NPL ratios are rising, you're talking about the traditional banks, not the... Right, okay. So these are the two separate issues. I do think we found kind of a possible solution to the very difficult financial inclusion problem by applying the digital finance, digital technology. In fact, I forgot to mention my bank, and the same for other online banks as well. While they're giving out so many loans in a year, the average non-performing loan ratio was 1.5%. They started from a relatively high ratio because they were learning about how to use machine learning and big data analysis to do credit risk assessment, but they're doing so much better now. I think you're right in terms of the commercial banks. I think the government is probably doing something not exactly right. For many years now, the government is trying to deal with the issue of the SME funding. But the policies they're always trying to promote are two. Number one is asking the banks to provide more bank loans to SMEs, which I think is fine if most of the banks are state-owned commercial banks. But the second policy they also advocate, which I think is ridiculous, is that they ask the banks to lower the lending rates, which makes it even just impossible for the banks to do the businesses with the relatively risky SMEs. Now, we mentioned earlier about the short lifespan of the SMEs. In China, the average lifespan is 4 or 5 years. And that means the risk is relatively high. When the government forced the banks to lend more money to the SMEs and ask them to lower the lending rate, either they don't want to do it, they just make a lot of tricks. And one of the stories I heard during the Chinese New Year, because last year we had a big crisis for SMEs and private enterprises, so the government made a big turnaround in the policy and forced everybody to extend more loans. One story I heard was during the Chinese New Year, one private entrepreneur was approached by his bank and to ask him to take more to take loans. And he said, I don't want loans because the business is doing okay, but the economy is taking a downturn. It's not the time for you to expand. The bank said, well, we've been supporting you for the past 20 years. It's time for you to support us. And she said, well, fine, but what are the terms? The bank said, well, we're going to lend you 20 million yuan. He said, that's too much. But the bank said, well, the interest rate is 2.8%. He said, well, that's fine. I can take it. And then the bank said, well, I will give you that money, but you're not allowed to use it. You can buy wealth management products we issue, which pays 4.8%. So in that game, the entrepreneur was happy because he, for no reason, he made a 2 percentage point interest spread. The bank was happy because now he can tell the government that we actually extend the loans to private enterprises. And I'm sure the premier would be happy when he saw the number. In fact, we saw the number at the end of March. The private sector loans, outstanding loans, was up by 19.1%, which was 5.4 percentage points higher than the average loan growth. So the premier could celebrate with himself about the policy. But this is exactly what is happening. So I think that is the background of the story you're talking about. If the banks are forced to make more loans, the NPL ratios will rise. And even with these good numbers we saw after March, we'll continue to see the government will be struggling with the same policy. So I think it's just the wrong policy. Now, fortunately, we have Alipay and WeChat Pay, which are not directly supported by the government, but they are doing the job of financial inclusion.
That was a very nice note to end on. So if you were so paying attention, Yiping just gave a very nice indictment of the state-owned financial system. Let's give the panelists a round of applause.